It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. We're up here on Signal Hill in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 36 degrees. They have a temperature of 34 degrees out at the airport, where they also have west winds at 6 miles per hour. They're calling for just a slight chance of rain and snow showers after 1 p.m. today, but otherwise partly sunny skies, and it is mostly sunny right now. They're predicting a high of 39 today. Northwest winds to 10, and they're expected to continue tonight, gusting as high as 20 tonight. Isolated snow showers tonight before 7 p.m., mostly cloudy skies overnight with a low around 30. Coming up on the Midday Report, the city of Kodiak has received its compensation study. Dylan Simard takes a look at it. And COVID numbers seem to be on the decline in Alaska. Those stories and more after this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., where other historic figures have been eulogized, bore witness today to the funeral of another, former Secretary of State Colin Powell. President Biden, former Presidents Obama and Bush, former Secretaries of State Clinton and Madeleine Albright all joined Powell's family to honor the soldier who would ascend the ranks of the military and diplomacy, shattering racial barriers along the way. That included becoming the first black person to serve as Secretary of State. Albright, the first woman confirmed to that post, credited Powell's impact on U.S. policy.
Colin Powell's legacy of service to the country he loved will long survive his passing. From rescuing fellow soldiers while in combat, to presiding over the rollback of aggression in the Middle East, to orchestrating after 9/11 a global alliance against Al-Qaeda, to modernizing the practice of diplomacy.
Respected as both a military and a diplomatic leader, Powell also acknowledged and expressed regret for his role in defending the Bush administration's rationale for going to war in Iraq. Powell died last month at the age of 84. The Biden administration is suing Texas over that state's restrictive new election law. From Houston Public Media, Andrew Schneider reports the Justice Department is challenging the law on relatively narrow grounds.
The suit targets two provisions of the Texas law. One places limits on assisting voters who need help navigating the voting process because of disabilities or limited English proficiency. The other places limits on how people who vote by mail verify their identities. Governor Greg Abbott responded to news of the lawsuit with a tweet saying, quote, "Bring it. In Texas, it is easier to vote but harder to cheat." I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The U.S. Department of Energy is announcing a new effort to fund technology that removes climate-warming carbon from the atmosphere. Here's NPR's Nathan Rod.
Put together our planes, cars, agriculture, power plants, all human activities, release about 40 billion metric tons of carbon pollution each year. That carbon then stays in the atmosphere, trapping the sun's heat and making our planet hotter. World leaders are gathering in Glasgow to try to cut those emissions going forward. But the announcement from the Department of Energy, which aims to reduce the cost of technology that sucks carbon from the air, shows that future emission cuts won't be enough to stop the harmful warming that's already in store. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Job growth in the U.S. was the strongest in 3 months. Labor Department reporting for October showing gain of 531,000 jobs. New unemployment rate of 4.6%. But President Biden still trying to convince congressional Democrats to back his domestic spending agenda as Democrats abruptly delayed a vote on one of the bills. It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
The city of Kodiak recently commissioned a compensation study to see how the wages it pays its workers compares with more than a dozen other similar municipalities. As KMXT's Dylan Simard reports, consultants say the pay is relatively low, but the benefits are good.
The city of Kodiak has relatively low salaries but remarkably good benefits. That's the takeaway from Halcyon Consulting, conducted by consultant Jonathan King, hired to review Kodiak City employee compensation and compare it around the state. He gave a presentation Tuesday night to the city council.
So you are not, certainly as a community, what we would consider to be a salary leader. All right, that's not what the data indicate.
King studied 14 different cities around Alaska to compare to Kodiak, among them places like Wasilla, Soldotna, Palmer, and Dillingham. Many of these cities have a higher hourly wage than Kodiak, but he says they don't really compensate much better when you factor in benefits like health and dental insurance. Retirement benefits were not studied by King since city government employees around the state all have access to the state of Alaska public employee retirement system. According to King, the take-home value at the end of the year is about the same. Ensuring a family in Kodiak can be done at almost no cost for city employees. In other communities, monthly premiums deducted from paychecks can be thousands of dollars.
In your health insurance, you are the only employer in the peer group to require no co-premiums. And if you are an individual with a family, that results in a savings of somewhere between $4,000 and $6,000 a year, right? Compared to many of the other employers. That would shift, you know, if we added that $4,000 to $6,000 in savings, you know, kind of into the effective pay of these individuals, right? That's worth $2 to $3 an hour, which would shift a number of these positions.
Now, that may seem like a great option for many families, but for younger people without dependents, it might be less appealing, King said. That's because they might be looking at take-home pay. And among early career police officers, firefighters, and administrative workers, there sure are a lot of younger people without dependents. Kodiak also offers very competitive paid time off. It's one of the best cities in the state for vacation days. So what should the city do? King says that's a policy call for the city council, which commissioned the study, to address relatively high turnover in its public sector workforce. King says just boosting wages isn't necessarily the answer.
That's not the takeaway from that study. It's rarely the takeaway from these studies. But you do have some pockets that I think you need to look at your total package and say, are we providing what we need to be providing in order to be competitive and to have people stay here and choose to make this island community their home, because we want them to stay. We want a healthy, vibrant community.
The city council is meeting again this week to discuss the findings of the compensation study. The full 92-page document can be found on our website at kmxt.org. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
Alaska's fall surge of the coronavirus appears to be past its peak, and health officials are hopeful the trend will continue. Speaking on a news call yesterday, Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, said nearly all data points show Alaska is headed in the right direction.
It has been really honestly relieving to see a slight decrease in our percent positivity, as well as the number of hospitalized patients secondary to COVID-19, and a slight decrease in our cases. We still have a lot of cases. We're still in that high zone. There's a lot of chances people can still get infected, but it's a much better trend.
Hospitalizations are down about a third from what they were a month ago. Weekly cases have dropped a similar amount, although Alaska's case rate is still the highest in the country, at about four times the national average. Zink says COVID continues to infect unvaccinated Alaskans at a much higher rate than those who are vaccinated. A report from the Department of Health and Social Services shows that unvaccinated residents are 11 times more likely to be hospitalized with COVID than those who've got the vaccine. Today, the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center reported 5 new cases of COVID-19 for the Kodiak Island Borough. All cases are now classified as community spread. 57 cases are currently active locally. There are no active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. While some parts of Alaska are seeing a decline in COVID cases, the island community of Petersburg in southeast is in an outbreak with 50 active COVID cases. 7 new positives were added last night to Thursday night. 17 of the cases are within the 3 schools, and there are 99 pending test results that providers are expecting to find more cases in to surface. As KFSK's Angela Denning reports, the outbreak is stressing staff at the local district and local medical center.
This outbreak is the third one Petersburg has seen in the pandemic, and it's on its way to becoming the worst. The first week of November was a rough week, says Phil Hofstetter, CEO of the Petersburg Medical Center.
Starting on Monday, we just got hammered with cases.
He says medical staff is trying to test and vaccinate the masses, as well as take care of patients like they normally would.
Our staffing is super thin, and we have people working incredibly long hours.
Not everyone is sticking around. Hofstetter says they lose staff every outbreak from burnout.
No question. Direct correlation to outbreaks. It's just super hard to do this. Fielding the calls, people are angry. You know, we can't get the messaging right. You know, it's we're providing too much information. We're providing too little information. You know, we can't get the test turnarounds. I mean, it all gets to our staff.
The Petersburg School District is also dealing with staff pressure, says Superintendent Erica Kluepainter.
They are tired. When these cases rise, it creates a lot of extra work. It adds a huge layer of stress on everyone.
She says a lot of staff are pulling extra shifts and taking over different classes. Some students are quarantining at home and attending school virtually. So teachers are tasked with hybrid classrooms, both online and in person. Kluepainter is not sure how much longer they can sustain the extra load.
It's really happening fast this week, you know, for sure. And right now our staffing is on the verge.
The school district is responsible for contact tracing among students and staff, which is a directive from the state. Kluepainter says through that, they've seen how much events and activities outside of the schools are affecting the students.
We are definitely being impacted by those. And it is, you know, it's taken our kids out, you know, for 8-10 days at a time, which is definitely, you know, having an impact on their learning and their time away from their peers, and certainly has an impact on their families.
Local medical providers, like Dr. Selena Burt, have also linked the current outbreak to gatherings in the community, as well as travel.
We have had people coming in and out for medical reasons, leaving the island and coming back, and part of it is related to that. We've had some community events occurring with churches and schools that look like they're related to some of the spread.
The medical center is low on rapid tests and is sending most tests out of town. The hospital gets an allotment of 120 rapid cartridges a month from the state, but have been saving them for high-risk individuals. So, some residents with symptoms are waiting days for their results. Burt says people should be patient and stay in quarantine.
If you have one person in your household that is confirmed positive, just assume that all of those other tests that have been sent out are going to be positive as well.
The hospital is starting to use some extra rapid tests that the school district has from the state, which give results in about 30 minutes. The school district is also encouraging families to take home some of the testing kits. Unfortunately, it looks like the outbreak won't slow down anytime soon. There were several gatherings around Halloween, and Burt says cases from those events are likely to surface in the coming days. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A large swath of Upper Cook Inlet will officially be closed to commercial salmon fishing next summer. The feds released a final rule this week adopting the proposed plans from the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which sets policy in Alaska's federal waters. Last December, the council voted to close part of Cook Inlet to commercial salmon fishing, an area that starts 3 miles offshore and extends from the southern tip of Kalgan Island to Anchor Point. Those waters have been managed by the state for a while, but the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, a commercial fishing advocacy group, disputed that management in a lawsuit several years ago, asking the feds to have some oversight. The council debated several management options last year, but when the state said it wouldn't manage the fishery jointly with the Fed opted to close the federal fishery entirely. The state waters portion will remain open. NOAA Fisheries said, quote, "The closure is consistent with the council's long-standing salmon management policy to facilitate salmon management by the state of Alaska and avoids the introduction of an additional management jurisdiction and the associated uncertainty into the complex and interdependent network of Cook Inlet salmon fishery sectors. Close quote. Fishermen have said it's the nail in the coffin for a fishery that's already on the decline. The drift fishery is the only fishery that operates in Cook Inlet's federal waters. Kenai Mayor Brian Gabriel, who's also a commercial fisherman, says he worries about the impact locally. He's one of several Kenai Peninsula leaders who sent letters to the feds earlier this year asking them to reconsider the council's decision.
We're concerned about the long-term effect that's going to have on our drift fleet, and then consequently the trickle effect to our processors here in Cook Inlet, which are really kind of hanging on right now by a thread.
But now that a final decision has been made, he said the only way he sees the area reopening is if there are changes made to the Magnuson-Stevens Act. That act sets the rules for fisheries management in federal waters. A last resort for fishermen could also be to appeal the decision in court. The decision is effective December 3rd. Two Alaska Native veterans who served during the Vietnam War received land conveyances on Thursday from the federal government. The two are Richard Boskovsky and Frank Nanuruk. Their allotments of up to 160 acres apiece are near Good News Bay in southwestern Alaska. They are the first to receive land from the Bureau of Land Management since Congress changed the rules in 2019 to make it easier for vets to qualify. A BLM spokeswoman said both men participated in a conveyance ceremony on Thursday. Boskovsky attended in person. Native allotments were a way that the federal government tried to put land ownership in the hands of individuals. In Alaska, the program was discontinued with the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. Congress reopened the application period to help veterans who may have missed the deadline because they were out of state serving their country. In an emailed statement, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said the department is committed to moving quickly so that, quote, Alaska Native Vietnam-era veterans are able to select the land allotments they are owed with an expansive selection area, close quote. The Interior Department contacted more than 1,400 vets and their families to let them know about the new rules. Nearly 130 applications were sent in. Veterans can continue to apply through 2025. Seven hunters from Pilot Station have been stuck at a fish camp for a week. The group includes a child. The hunters were headed upriver after fall seal hunting on the Yukon. They got stuck outside of Eminac on their way home. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has this report.
It's traditional for hunters from Lower Yukon River villages to travel down to the coast in the fall to hunt for seal to stock their freezers for the winter. Especially this year, since subsistence fishing for most salmon species was closed after the Yukon River saw a massive chum salmon collapse. Normally, hunters are able to get to the coast and back home this time of year, no problem. But former mayor of Pilot Station, Abraham Kelly, says this year winter weather snuck up on them.
And it got cold a lot faster than what we thought it would be.
As the hunters were making their way upriver, ice began forming across the water. Just past Demonic, they couldn't go any further. Four of the seven hunters volunteer with the local search and rescue in Pilot Station, so they knew to contact the nearby Demonic Search and Rescue from their in-reach device. According to Demonic Search and Rescue, the hunters provided their location and the Demonic group directed them to the nearest fish camp. The hunters pulled over. Between what they brought and what was at the fish camp, they had enough to feed themselves and stay warm for several days. But according to the Alaska State Troopers, the weather soon turned foggy and turbulent, too risky to land an aircraft. But on day three, troopers were able to do a flyby drop-off of food, supplies, and medications needed by one of the hunters in the group. The group needs to be rescued by air because the river and overland trails are not yet frozen enough for snow machines or other vehicles. The entire area is off the road system. Back in Pilot Station, the head of the local search and rescue group, Paul Fancyboy, had gotten word that his friends and his second-in-command were stuck near Demonic. He was concerned that no one had rescued them yet, so on day four, he says he called Governor Mike Dunleavy's office. He reached an aide.
He said he was taking notes and he was going to give it to the governor. And I wouldn't know. He hadn't called me back about why it took those guys so long to get rescued.
He says the governor never called him back, and the number for the governor's office. The next day, day five, troopers attempted to evacuate the group with a fixed-wing aircraft. But according to a spokesperson for Aemonic Search and Rescue, the pilot couldn't land due to a heavy crosswind. The spokesperson said the men were starting to get agitated, that it had been 5 days and no one had picked them up yet. Aemonic Search and Rescue coordinated another flyby food drop. This time, the food was donated by the local AC store and the village store, and the flight was donated by Grant. The drop included a charger for the Hunter's InReach satellite. The group is using it to communicate with Aemonic Search and Rescue. The mood at camp briefly lifted. Plus, the weather was looking good for the next day. Aemonic Search and Rescue told the Hunters to pack their gear in and get ready. The Coast Guard's helicopter Nome was preparing to pick them up, but on day six, the chopper never came. The weather turned once more, according to former mayor of Pilot Station, Abraham Kelly.
Well, finally, they were going to pick them up yesterday morning, and then that fog rolled in again, so they canceled the chopper from Nome was supposed to pick them up.
He said another fog had rolled in Thursday morning, and the Coast Guard confirmed that, as of yet, they've not been able to get the boaters. As of Thursday afternoon, Aemonic Search and Rescue was working on coordinating a third food drop. But Kelly was concerned about the group's ability to keep warm.
But they're running out of wood to burn. They just need wood to stay warm, so we're kind of worried about them now.
Paul Fancyboy, the head of Pilot Station Search and Rescue, says the whole village is getting worried about the Hunters. He says the youngest in the group is a grade school kid who's missing school this week. Fancy Boy says this whole ordeal is taking way too long, and he's frustrated.
I don't know why they're taking them so long. I don't think it's acceptable.
A spokesperson from Aemonic Search and Rescue also demanded to know why it was taking so long for government rescue agencies to get the Hunters. A chopper didn't come on day seven either, but it may Friday on day eight. According to a report from state troopers, the U.S. Coast Guard helicopter in Nome was unable to launch Thursday due to mechanical issues, and there were no private helicopters available in the area at the time to assist. Troopers say two U.S. Army helicopters from Fort Wainwright are traveling to the area Thursday and are planning to pick up the group Friday morning. For KYUK, I'm Olivia Eberts.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A push to pull back salmon hatcheries is again on the Fish Board agenda. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska salmon hatcheries are again on the agenda this month at the Board of Fisheries meeting at Cordova. Seven proposals by two entities aim to curtail production at Prince William Sound, where six hatcheries operate, claiming that the fish harm wild stocks. The hatchery salmon are from wild stocks. In 2019, 15 million salmon that began their lives in hatcheries were caught at Prince William Sound, accounting for 70% of the total commercial catch. According to the annual Salmon Enhancement Report by Fish and Game, the value to fishermen of nearly $27 million was 67% of the total value for the region. About 220 seiners fish in Prince William Sound, hailing from 22 Alaska communities, along with nearly 520 drift gillnetters from 30 towns. Often lost in the hatchery picture is that they operate with no state dollars and the contribution the fish make to other users. Tina Fairbanks, director of the Kodiak Regional Aquaculture Association, explained at a 2019 Fish Board meeting at Seward.
Through statute, we're provided the opportunity to offer a licensing agreement on an annual basis on the returning adult salmon is the process we call cost recovery. Those cost recovery activities allow us to recoup our operational expenses. These facilities produce salmon for the common property that includes sport, subsistence, personal use, and commercial fisheries at no cost to the state of Alaska.
When asked at a packed 2018 Fish Board meeting how many people depended on hatchery fish for their livelihood, over half stood up. Deadline to comment directly to the Fish Board is noon on November 15th. The board meets at the Cordova Convention Center from November 30th through December 6th. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the fifth day of November, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 9:33. It will set again at 6:12 this evening. That will give us 8 hours and 39 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 32 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 60. That was set in 1924. And our record low was 7, set in 1975 and 1985. Currently 37 degrees, sunny skies. They're still calling for slight chance of rain and snow this afternoon after 1. Northwest winds to 10, continuing this evening, coming up to 20. Low around 30 overnight tonight, and isolated snow showers before 7 p.m. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 33, and those northwest winds continuing to 20. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 2:36 this afternoon. That will be 11 feet, followed by a low tide at 9:16 p.m., a minus tide, minus 2 feet. Our next high tide will be at 3:41 a.m. and be 8.5 feet, followed by a morning low tide at 9:07 in the morning of 1.6 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 3:11 this afternoon and be 17.4 feet, followed by a low tide at 9:49 this evening of minus 3.7 feet in Larsen Bay. And your next high tide will be at 4:04 a.m. and be 14.8 feet, followed by a low tide at 9:50 tomorrow morning of 1.7 feet. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side offshore. Small craft advisory through Saturday. Northwest 25, except southwest 15, north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 8 feet. And for tonight, northwest 30, seas coming up to 9 feet. And for tomorrow, northwest 30, seas to 9 feet. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory tonight and Saturday. Northwest 20, seas to 3 feet. For tonight, northwest 25, seas to 5 feet. And for tomorrow, northwest 25, seas remaining at 5 feet in the Shelikof. The borough is having a consolidation committee meeting next Monday. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. in the borough conference room. Also, Fire Protection Area Number 1 is having their board meeting. That's happening Tuesday at 6 p.m. in the Bayside Fire Hall. The Assembly is having a work session on Tuesday as well. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. at the School District Conference Room. And the Assembly is having a regular meeting next Thursday, November 18th, at 6:30 p.m. in the Bayside Fire Hall.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
KMXT is supported in part by Orion's Mountain Sports, featuring equipment, clothing, and footwear for your outdoor lifestyle. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the November 5th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman.
If you were out and about on Wednesday night or even early Thursday morning, you likely saw the Northern Lights. It was quite a show. In fact, I can only think of two others similar to it in the 30-plus years I've lived on the island. The solar conditions in the past week or so made for the perfect storm of aurora, a geomagnetic storm to be exact. Usually, Earth's magnetic shield protects our atmosphere from the particles the sun sends out into the universe. Sometimes, though, the sun sends out a huge explosion of energy and gas called a coronal mass ejection, or CME. Sometimes the supercharged particles from the CME make it past the magnetic shield at the poles of the Earth. Then the particles dance with the gases in our atmosphere, causing all sorts of excitement. When oxygen is excited by the electrons, it gives off green and red light. Nitrogen glows purple and blue. To add to the perfect storm on Wednesday night and Thursday morning, the sun sent out two CMEs toward the Earth. The first was gobbled up by the second, creating an even bigger energy force headed our way. Like Pac-Man getting stronger by gobbling up things in his way. Scientists call CMEs like the second one a cannibal CME. Me, I'll stick with the Pac-Man analogy. However you think of it, those of you who saw the show likely won't forget it for a while. If you'd like to learn more about auroras and how to watch for conditions where the chances of seeing aurora are greater, check out nasa.gov or spaceweather.com. That's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.